Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 326 of the podcast. It's Saturday, 17th of June, 2017, as I record this. Today, I have an interview with Rebecca Cantrell, multi-award-winning and international best-selling mystery author. And Becky spans traditional and indie publishing, and she's incredibly well-read in the mystery genre. And we have a really fun conversation about writing mystery, which also, you know, spills into crime and thriller and other genres. And of course, you can have mysteries in any subgenre, like, romantic suspense is sort of mystery along with romance. There are mysteries in space, in fantasy world. So I hope that whatever you write, you will find this useful. So in publishing this week, some very exciting news. Draft Digital announced their partnership with Findaway Voices, an audiobook creation and distribution service which gives authors more freedom and control over their work. You can create and sell audiobooks to listeners in more than 170 countries through the world's largest audiobook distribution network. So this is big news, but bigger news for many of you is this is open to everyone worldwide. So ACX has only been open to US, UK, and now Australia, Canada recently, but this partnership between Drafter Digital and Findaway Voices is open to everyone. So whatever country you are in the world, you should be able to use it. And I know many people are already using Drafter Digital for things, but this is huge news, I think, because as I talked about last week in the various news segments, you know, audiobooks continue to grow in popularity. Other exciting things about this. So first of all, you set the price, own the rights. So there's no exclusivity. You control the distributors. So setting the price and not having an exclusivity clause is pretty amazing, because that's two of the problems with ACX. They are, you know, they do have an exclusivity if you want the higher royalties, and you can't set the price. So this is huge news. So the distribution sites include Audible and iTunes and Amazon. So that's pretty exciting. So you don't miss out on any of those big players, but you're also available on a whole load of other things. You get high level customer support, as you'd expect from Drafter Digital. And if you already have an audiobook, so I have several audiobooks that I've produced privately, and then I've used non-exclusive distribution through ACX, you can use Findaway Voices without exclusivity and at no cost. There is a setup fee if you do the if you do work with them, but it's, you know, minimal and, you know, pretty, I think, very, very good deal. So this is launching July 18th, 2017, and I will be looking at it for my audiobooks that are non-exclusive to ACX. So very, very good news for indies and audiobooks, and awesome that Drafter Digital are doing this. And I've been hearing rumors about this for a while. And if you listen back to the interview with Dan Sawyer, I guess it was earlier this year, we kind of talk about, you know, don't jump in too soon, there's things coming. So very excited to hear about this. Go check that out at drafttodigital.com. And or as usual, there the links will be in the show notes. Another couple of interesting things. Amazon buys Whole Foods. Now, why is this interesting for publishing? I think there's a couple of reasons why this is interesting. First of all, in the UK, supermarkets are a huge market for select book sales. Now, they heavily discount, but authors who get picked up for supermarket deals can often do very well. Now, people buying books with their food shopping seems to be an established route to market for some people. So I wonder whether Amazon you know, might consider merchandising books alongside other things within Whole Foods. It is certainly an interesting thing alongside Amazon Fresh that they're getting into food delivery. And also, this will mean that Amazon will continue to invest in distribution systems, which are one of their very competitive factors. So could drone delivery of a book along with your bananas be on its way? I think it probably will be. I'm not sure how long that will take, but I certainly think that the improvements in distribution, I'm pretty sure they must be investing in self-driving vehicles and other things like that. So if you think about how we really need to harness technology to, you know, keep ourselves competitive in the market, I think this is an interesting development. Also, IPR license launches online buy rights button. So IPR license is essentially like a marketplace for rights deals. It's associated with Frankfurt Book Fair, and it essentially says, this feature will ensure a straightforward automated process for the buying of translation rights. You can also customize the account so that low value or backlist rights transactions will be automatically processed by the platform's payment system. And the feeling seems to be that these low value translation rights, and low value for the traditional publishing industry, you know, might be sort of 2,000 euro for, Dutch rights, for example, or, you know, things where you wouldn't necessarily, you know, do massive high stakes negotiation for like a 6-7, there are even 8-figure deals still being done in publishing. I mean, you know, there's big deals being done, but this is for the low rights, the low value translation rights in the background. So, you know, Swedish rights, for example, or, you know, different languages around the world where having somebody responsible for that means the overhead is too much. So I think this is fascinating because this will happen for indies now, whether it will be the next one year or 3 years, but this will be available. So I think you'll be able to put a button on your website that will say, you know, these rights deals are available. And how I see the expansion of digital and the expansion of the self-publishing world is that as authors mature in their publishing environment, so take me, for example, we set up Curl Up Press earlier this year, not necessarily to ever publish anyone else, but to publish JF Penn, Joanna Penn, and our sweet romance author in a more professional manner, and to be have a sort of third party name, Curl Up Press, instead of the Creative Pen, which has my name in it. So to have like a one step removed rights approach. And we're going to be looking at, you know, translation rights and other things through Curl Up Press. But what this means, I think, is also, this is happening in other countries. So there was a great blog post this week on the Creative Pen from Cyril Godefroy, who, hello Cyril, translated some of my nonfiction into French. And his post about the French market is really interesting because what's happening in France is that people like Cyril are setting up publishing houses, small presses, and working with other authors across the world doing these types of rights deals privately. Now, I think that will only continue. So as digital continues the march around the world, there will be more and more smaller publishing houses set up. It won't just be, you know, to publish in India, you have to deal with, you know, these top five publishers. There will be lots more opportunity to deal with smaller houses. And this type of digital rights deals, I think, will become increasingly popular. So very interesting. And I've got an interview coming up in a couple of weeks with Sean Black, who has been doing pretty well with Babel Cube. Babel Cube is a sort of translation, indie translation rights sharing service with translators. And I've heard very negative things and very positive things. So I think that's another interesting model. And they've actually announced this week partnering with StreetLib to distribute to more platforms as well. So we're moving into this increasingly mature publishing environment with translation rights. And this is really good because, as ever, I was early on this a couple of years ago and didn't make any money and pulled my books because it was just impossible to market. But what's happening now is things are starting to happen. So when I talk about something, I'm probably 3 years early. I should learn my lesson, right? I mean, I really should. Audio is another example. I licensed my first three Arcane books because ACX wasn't available to the UK. And if I'd have just waited a year or a couple of years, it would have been fine. So yes, don't do what I do. Wait until it's more mature. But I do think this right stuff is very, very interesting. And I think it will become increasingly used. It's also related to a very interesting article in The New Scientist, which came out a week or so ago. And depending on where you sit on the positive side of technology or the negative side, you may or may not find this fascinating. You all know that I'm on the positive side of most things. but the headline was, AI will be able to beat us at everything by 2060. Now, I tend to think of AI more as like a tool. Like right now I'm using a microphone, I'm using software, I'm going to distribute to you over the internet. You know, I think AI will be more like that. I think it will enable us to do more of what we love doing and do less of what we hate doing. So, for example, I will appreciate the day when an AI can do all of my accounting and bookkeeping and, you know, all the stuff that you don't want to do manually. but one thing that came out of this article that I thought was fascinating was machines are predicted to be better than us at translating languages by 2024. Now, that's not very far away. You know, that's what, 7 years from now? That will change a lot in publishing. Now, this is my pick. Okay, and again, I can be right about things, but I'm often early. So, but this made me look up because I've said before that I think we won't need translation. I think because there are already apps that you can point at signs and they translate in real time. There's Skype translator where you can actually have a conversation and have it translate in real time. The voice recognition technology with the Echo, Google Home, the other things that are using, you know, voice recognition now. This is improving so fast that I think what will happen by 2024 is we'll be wearing our glasses or our contact lenses or using whatever device we read on, and we'll be able to buy a book written in French and we'll be able to read it in English or vice versa or whatever language it is. So I think translation will be going the way of vinyl and digital music and audiobooks in a way. So for example, right now you can use you know, the Kindle device and other devices to read your books out loud, your Kindle books out loud, and you don't need to have an audiobook produced. There is a text-to-speech app that will do that for you, but it won't bring the nuance and the performance of a professional narrator that makes listening to an audiobook, you know, very enjoyable. But what I think will be that audiobooks and translation will go the way of vinyl, in that there will be mass market AI translated versions and there'll be artisan translations of some works where you will still pay a skilled translator to do something more artistic. And that might be around more poetry, literary fiction, etc. But what we've seen, you know, with some of this stuff already, and you can see it if you use even something as basic as Google Translate. If you take a sentence from your non-fiction writing and put it into Google Translate, there's a chance that it's going to be pretty accurate. If you put something in fiction in, it may not get that right because of the nuance of fiction, subtext and all of these types of things, language choice, word choice. So I'm really interested in this. So that's kind of my pick in the next 10 years. And I'm thinking about the next 10 years at the moment and what we want to do, you know, and trying not to move too fast, trying to see when would be the right time to do stuff. Yeah, so mass market translation of books by AI in the next 10 years, which is not very far off. And that will change foreign rights sales significantly, because of course, if people have access to AI tools, they won't need the translated book. So very interesting. Now, there might, of course, be a license around, say, if you have to have the book available in English, so you actually license the right to sell in those countries, which, of course, indie books are already available in most of these countries through Kobo, through iBooks, through Amazon, through, you know, all the other options, of which there are many. But I think this is very exciting. I hope you're excited too. I only see this as getting better and better, to be fair. And I will link to all those things in the show notes. Okay. So in my personal update this week, I've done my first 10,000 words in the first in my new map series. And I'm in that, oh no, everything is a pile of crap phase, where I'm just kind of like, oh, what am I doing? This is so bad. But I'm concentrating on just getting it down at this point. And I'm not sure that this self-doubt ever goes away. And I have to reread my own successful author mindset book to remind myself that this is what happens every time. And you just have to ride the roller coaster of the creative process. And it's entirely part of what happens. And to prove to myself that it will turn out all right, my certificate of nomination arrived from the International Thriller Writers this week for Destroyer of Worlds in the Best Ebook Original category. And I am off to New York City on July the 10th, and I will find out on the 15th of July if I've won. So of course I will be letting you all know after that. I've also been doing some dead link removal on thecreativepen.com, and thanks to Nate Hofelder from The Digital Reader, who did the bulk of it. And then I had to do just a few posts. And it's incredible what the dead links are, if you don't know, is over time, as you link to people from your website to their website, if their website disappears, you get like a broken link on your website, and Google doesn't like broken links. So you have to remove them over time. And what was fascinating about, you know, and I started blogging, The Creative Pen was started in December 2008. So we're coming up on 10 years next year. And it is... it's really interesting how many people have disappeared since I started blogging and writing in 2008, how many websites have gone, how many, you know, book websites have gone, how many things that we had to unlink from. So that was interesting because, of course, people change direction. People decide this is not the right thing for them. They decide it's all too much work. That's becoming more common. They decide they just want to do this for fun. They don't necessarily want to maintain all of this, or they just change direction. And when you're thinking about your author brand and what you want to do for the next 10 years, I think that's what you really have to focus on. So one of the questions I get a lot is, you know, what domain name should I use? Should I use the domain name for my book title? And I always say, no, don't, because you won't be wanting to maintain your book title website in the next couple of years because you'll have moved on to a different book. That was the first mistake I made was the first website I set up was called howtoenjoyyourjob.com. Ah, such a terrible, terrible name. And basically that was the name of the first book. Should have been Career Change, which is what I rebranded later on. But even if it had been Career Change, I wouldn't be maintaining it now because I wrote that book and then I was done with Career Change. It is not a topic I wanted to blog about or be an expert on. So when you're looking at building your career for the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, so I'm 42, I fully expect to be doing this for at least 50 more years. I don't know whether I'll be podcasting for the next 50 years. I hope you'll be joining me in VR in a couple of years' time when we do this. But it is really interesting how people disappear. And I just want that to be a bit of a lesson today for everyone. You know, where do you want to be in the next 5 to 10 years' time? Are you intending your author career to be something that has longevity? What do you want to achieve by 2027? For example, the next 10 years' time? Will you still be an author? Will you still be writing? What do you want to do? So there you go. There's my deep and meaningful for today. Quite a lot of deep and meaningful, actually, isn't there? I've got in my list of things to do to review my year's goal. Because of course, to achieve things in 10 years, you have to break that down into smaller chunks. And I set my annual goals in January every year, and we're coming up to the middle of the year, which is kind of scary. But I'll probably go through that next week or the week after, just giving you an update. And I like having accountability with you guys. So, you know, I'm up to 10,000 words on the MacBook, although I'm off to London. Oh, that's something actually that's happening this week. I'm speaking at a debate on Monday night this week against a literary agent in the Groucho Club in London, which is very, very industry. And the debate is whether self-publishing is just vanity. And the questions are very pointed around the sort of how bad self-publishing is. So it will probably be, I'll probably have a couple of gins, and it will be a bit of a confrontational affair. And I'm not very good at confrontation, but this is something that I care about. So it'll be a very interesting evening. So watch out on Twitter for things about that this week. Okay, so thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments this week. Oh yes, Christine Bernard said, I love the podcast. I think it's time to read my first J.F. Penn novel now. Where should I start? In case anyone else is wondering that, start with Desecration if you like crime. End of Days is my latest thriller, and Destroyer of Worlds is the award-nominated book, and Stone of Fire is free. So there you go. Jennifer Eremiva said, heart-stopping moment. Has the creative pen taken a summer hiatus? And then she says, phew, just needed to refresh my podcast feed. Imagine the horror. It's funny, I have actually been considering, maybe moving to seasons but then I always have so much to say every week to you guys. So imagine if I did stop for a summer, I don't know what I would do with myself. So we did change over HTTPS a couple of weeks ago, and it did affect the feed. So apologies about that. Meg Cowley says, crazy busy day, treating myself to a walk, listening to the show ahead of tomorrow's book launch. Sent me some lovely pictures. J.E. Brand, listening to the show while driving through the Smokies. The inspiration is flowing everywhere. Very beautiful pictures. Thank you, J.E. Emily Selleck says, way behind on podcasts, but have to say, listening to the Creative Pen and Dan Sawyer from episode 318, geek out about space rights, made me grin. And very good timing there, Emily. Maybe you'll eventually catch up to this episode where we talk more about audio, but there you go. Sally Stevenson says, listening to the show while at my day job, thinking about how life will slowly change when I release my first book soon. Sally, thank you so much. And I think this is great. It's so important to take that first step, and life will slowly change. That's what's so crazy about looking back at the last 10 years of my life, 2006 when I first started writing, and now 2017, It is a very slow change at first, and you think everything is going so slowly, and then it really, really speeds up. Janelle Robish, love the show. Problem is, I listen before bed and have to re-listen when I'm more awake. And Amy, lots of people doing book launches. Amy Cesari, listening to the show while basking in the glory of my latest and most successful book launch yet. Just kidding. And finally, thank you to JT Lawrence, who dedicated her book How We Found You to me, which was very wonderful, for positivity and shining the light. I'm so thrilled to help you, and many of you include me in your acknowledgements, and it always makes me a bit teary because back when I started this site, I set the goal to help 1 million books into the world. Obviously not the books I would be writing myself, but every one of you who finds me help along your journey, I count your book as one of my million. So thank you so much. And yeah, I'm really, really happy to continue doing the show. I really do find it very rewarding to help you birth your books into the world. Okay, so today's show is actually sponsored by the Mystery and Dark Crime Bundle that Rebecca Cantrell and I are in, along with a whole load of New York Times bestselling and multi-award winning authors. This is a hell of a bundle, to be honest. It contains historical mysteries from 1931 Berlin to 1981 New Orleans, 21st century stories from internet stalking to teenage bullying, international crime fiction from London grave robbers, yes, that will be my desecration, to a Toronto medical mystery. With the inclusion of more than 30 short stories, it not only covers every single mystery and crime subgenre, but you can sample stories from grandmasters and first timers alike. So the bundle contains my novel Desecration, the book where I really found my voice, my fiction voice, and a book that means a lot to me. And you can find the bundle at storybundle.com/mystery. It's available for a limited time, 14th of June to 6th of July. It's a pay what you like deal with a percentage going to our handpicked charity. So go binge read and get that mystery bundle at storybundle.com/mystery. Okay, so this corporate type of sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a huge thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons this week, Connor Bredin, Jack McSporran, and Amanda J. Clay. And thank you to all of you who've been supporting the show for so long. I really appreciate your support. And I recorded the extra monthly Q&A this week, so you will have that in your feed. And you can also get that onto your iTunes or your whatever device you listen on quite easily. And I talk about it in there using the RSS feed on your Patreon page. And on Patreon, if you would like to get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which is now like our 18 months worth of Q&A, you can support me with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous. So go to patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, let's get on with the interview. Today, I'm here with Rebecca Cantrell. Hi, Becky.
Hi, Joanna.
It's great to have you back on the show. Just a little introduction. Rebecca is a New York Times and USA Today best-selling and multi-award winning thriller and mystery author. Her series include the Hannah Vogel historical thrillers set in 1930s Berlin, the Joe Tesla contemporary thrillers, the Order of the Sanguine supernatural thrillers with James Rollins, which I love, and the Malibu mysteries with Sean Black. And today we're talking about how to write a mystery. Just checking, Becky, how many books have you written now?
17.
Ah, there we go.
My son made me count them up. Like, I don't know, 15 or so.
Yeah.
Make a list.
Now, we both write thrillers and also mysteries. And I described your Hannah Vogel series there as thrillers, but then also mysteries. So what do you think is the difference between a mystery and a thriller, or can they be combined?
I think there is a lot of play in the differences. So I think the basic difference that most people would say when they talk about it is a mystery is about figuring out who solved a crime. So who was the killer, who committed a crime, and solving it and restoring justice to the world. Whereas a thriller is kind of more about suspense. So you know the Hitchcock saying about suspense, where he says if you have a bomb and it blows up, that's surprise. But if you have a bomb and you put it under a table and the audience sees the bomb, then they come in and you have people come in and they're walking around and they're talking. And then the audience is getting more and more uneasy because they know these people could die at any moment. And he said, and that's suspense. And I think thrillers go more towards suspense, where you know something terrible is going to happen. You have some idea of what it is. And the story hinges on, will that evil plot be stopped? And how will it be stopped? Mm. So it's more about discovery versus suspense, I think.
Yeah. And do you think there's often more of a pacing or a high stakes element in thriller? Because, you know, a mystery, like cozy mystery, is a big subgenre. And it can be, you know, a very small town, small thing. Whereas thrillers, there's often a much bigger thing at stake. You know, with my, you know, with the Sanguines or with some of my supernatural thrillers, it really is, you know, ultimate evil going to destroy the world type of thing. So do you think that sort of stakes and also pacing pacing would come into it as well.
I think that's true. I think the epic kind of stage of most thrillers. But then you can think of things like Misery, which is not a mystery, but it is a thriller. And that's really just the stake of that one guy's life and will he be killed by his number one fan. So kind of the Stephen King Misery book. So I think that you can make thrillers that are very personal, but most of them are more epic in scope. So if you look at the centuries, that spans 2,000 years and 5 continents and, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, our supernatural thrillers, yeah, fit in that big, big thing. And also, there's no mystery if you know the antagonist, right? So many thrillers, you actually know who the bad guy is and you know who is committing the big crimes. And it's not a case of who it is. It's more about stopping them.
Yeah, yeah. Will the guy stop them? And will the main character find out who they even are? But I also think there's thrillers where that doesn't happen, you know, where I think in thrillers, there's a little more leeway to let the bad guy win. So if you look at Silence of the Lambs, which is a thriller, in the end, Hannibal Lecter wins. He gets away. I mean, she also wins because she, you know, saves the girl who's been kidnapped and she gets that serial killer, Buffalo Bill. But the other one, the bigger, more dangerous one, leaves. And I think thrillers have more of a license to do that. I think if you do that with mysteries, the readers will get angry.
Yes, you can't have the bad guy get away, really, at the end of a mystery, unless I guess it's a series. And we'll come back to series. But let's talk about the obligatory scenes, because, you know, if you want to write a mystery, there are things that readers expect. So, for example, the crime, usually a murder. Is it always a murder? There's a good question. Is it always a murder in a mystery?
I don't think it has to be. So if you look like the second Hannah Fogel mystery, she's kidnapped at the beginning and her child was taken away. And for the first half of the book, she's really just trying to get him back. And then there's a murder and she solves the murder and finds her son. But the first half, there isn't a body. So it doesn't have to have a body right away. But I think traditionally you're supposed to have a body by the end of the prologue or chapter one. The body drops and you know what the stakes are and you know where it's going to go. I think that's the traditional mystery plot. And I think most mysteries do follow that. And then at the end, you're going to have the wrap up where you find out who the killer is. And then some sense that justice has been served. Either the killer will go to jail or the killer will be punished in some other way so that, you know, the reader gets catharsis of knowing that the world is a just place and things have gone well.
Yeah, which is exactly what happens in the real world.
It's what you want to happen in the real world. I think that's something people get out of mysteries, that they read them because they want to see order restored. They want to see the bad guys lose and the good guys win. Even in places where there are no murders. Like I think in Iceland, for example, I think there are almost no murders. But if you look at Iceland noir, people are dropping like flies. So there's obviously, realistic, there's some kind of catharsis that they're getting out of it.
Yeah, no, that's right. Okay, so we've got the body at the beginning and, of course, the roundup at the end. But then some of the other obligatory scenes. So the clues and the red herrings, there have to be, and also the number of suspects. I think that was something when I wrote my mystery series, I realised that, with my thrillers, there's often just one massive antagonist who has an all-powerful organisation that they have to destroy. But with mystery, you have to have multiple possible antagonists, don't you? So multiple suspects and those clues and red herrings. Would that be right?
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, I would say usually, I'm 97% of the time, but yes, I would say usually you want to have multiple antagonists and multiple ideas of who the villain is. And it can't be the obvious one. So if you have someone who seems like the obvious killer throughout most mystery books, that person is not, in fact, going to be the killer. So you hope as a reader that you can keep, or as a writer, that you can keep the readers guessing till the end and that they won't figure out who the killer is until you want to reveal it or shortly before you want to reveal it. That's cool.
Yeah, but also, doesn't the real killer have to appear in the first, let's say, quarter to a third of, like, I think that, like, they should appear at the beginning. You can't just suddenly bring in the killer at the end. So you have to at least have them appear, but you have to misdirect the reader so they don't suspect that person.
Well, there's a rule that says you're supposed to have met the killer by the end of act one. So that would be, you know, a quarter of the way through the book. You either have to have met them or they have to have been referred to. So then you have to, you know, as a writer, you have to figure out how to misdirect people away from that person or make that person seem like they have an airtight alibi or they don't seem to be that interested or for whatever reason, you have to kind of push back.
Mm. And for that reason, I think that mysteries need a larger cast because you have to have enough characters that you misdirect to at least, let's say, three. You know, you can't just have one other misdirection. You kind of need three. So how do you, when you're planning yours, how do you come up with a cast that, you know, will make that possible?
Well, I usually start with the murder victim. So you have someone who's been killed, and then you have to figure out who would kill them. So often for some of my mysteries, I will write down what actually happened. So I think there's the story of what actually happened, what you tell, what the reader thinks, and what the reader thinks happened. So I often actually write in very truncated form. I write down, okay, this is what happened, da 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 da. And then I know that I'm never breaking the rule of what actually happened. And then I look at the murder victim and you have to figure out who else would have killed them and why. And that goes back to their character, you know, who would want to murder them. And so you need someone who has enemies or who is in the way of a certain number of people. And so for me, it's about plotting. Although I know writers who do not plot and write mysteries and they have no idea who the killer is. And they write beginning to end and then do a second draft where they nothing. Like Kelly Stanley, for instance, she writes The City of Dragons in the Miranda Corby series. She writes her whole first draft and then does minor edits and she's done and she really doesn't know. And they're brilliant books. It's quite frustrating for those of us who write a million drafts, but you know, some people can pull that off.
Yeah, well, I think that is one of the questions because I did find that with my London, I call them London crime thrillers, but they're mysteries. You know, there is a detective and it's very difficult to put these things in genre sometimes. But I did find that I had to do quite a lot more plotting than I would do on a thriller in terms of, oh, right, I need the misdirection here. I need to put a clue here to sort of point them to those people. So have you found that, I mean, you, obviously there are some people, as you mentioned, who don't plot, but is your plotting a lot heavier for mystery than some of your other books?
I would say no. I would say
you're a plotter.
I'm a plotter. Although the book with Rollins, we didn't actually plot nearly as much as my regular books. So he's like, oh, we'll totally plot this. And then we were really just plotting a few scenes in advance. I mean, we knew what the tent poles were. We knew what we were shooting for, but the details were worked out as in the writing, but he is like a plot machine. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we'd be writing on, be like, I think we need more here. And then, we need 50 pages because this has to happen. And there's this much stuff. And he'd be like, okay. And then he would just sit there. You could see him load the whole plot into his head, which takes him about 10 seconds. And then he would just like come up with all the stuff that fit in for that. And I do not have that plotting gene. It takes me a lot longer to figure out what might happen and to go over stuff. Mm.
But I guess, you know, actually, I mean, having read some of your books, your single author books are probably more character focused than plot. You know, as in some, James Rollins being one of my favorite authors, you know, in your books, I think that certainly Hannah's, you know, are very character centric. So what makes a good main character, especially if you're planning a mystery series?
Well, for Hannah, let me just say, honestly, I didn't expect the books to be a series. So I wrote the first book and then I sold it to Tor and they, Tor Forge, and they said, we'll only buy it if it's a series. What's the second book? And then I had to come up with a whole second book plot by Monday. And I'm like, of course, if there's a series. And I'm like, okay, honey, you're in charge of the baby. I'm out. And then I spent the whole weekend trying to figure out what she could do next and what the rest of the books could be like. So with that in mind, know that I didn't actually design it going in. But I think that you need, for a good main character in a series to work, I think you need a character that people are fascinated by and want to spend time with. So usually that's someone who's likable, someone who's complex, someone who's flawed, and someone who's intriguing. So, for example, somebody like Hannibal Lecter or Dexter, those are very flawed characters that you wouldn't like in real life and you wouldn't want to spend time with in real life, but they're fascinating in fiction. And so they pull you, or Lestat, they pull you forward just by the force of their personality and you want to know about them. Mm-hmm. So I think they have to be someone that you want to know more about, someone you want to go on a journey with. And I know when I've read books, and if there's nobody I can hang on to and usually like, then I can't get engaged with the book. And I know there are people who love books that have unlikable protagonists or unlikable, a whole set of unlikable characters, but I have real trouble with that. Like when I read Gone Girl, for instance, it's very well put together. I couldn't stand anybody in the book. So I was kind of annoyed. Like I read through it and it was well done, but I just didn't like anyone. And that's the point of it. They did what they were trying to do. But ordinarily for books like that, I just get, you know, after 50 pages or something, I just get bored.
Mm. So I think, you know, what we're saying there is the sort of make them, even if not likable, somebody you want to spend time with across multiple books. So and understandable in some way and complex in some way. So my main character, Jamie Brooke, Jamie being a woman in this, you know, has a terminally ill daughter, and she's a policewoman in London, but she dances tango to escape from her life at night. So she kind of becomes this different person. And I mean, that was really fun to research, like, you know, tango dancing. And I read this book at the time and I was like, wow, that's really cool. I'm going to have my character dance tango at night. And
do you do tango?
I've tried, but I'm a bit like two left feet. I like the idea of being an amazing tango dancer, but not like the 20 years of work that goes into it. But, but I think that complexity, I think, would be another thing, is like bringing a level of complexity to your character. So, and trying to step away from the cliche. So I think you do have to have some kind of wound, like as in they are a wounded hero in some way, but not just like that they're the hard drinking divorced male cop with a paunch.
Yeah, who likes jazz. I mean, who is basically, you know, Raymond Chandler's character.
Oh, but there we go. And that became a bit of a trope. So what's different about Hannah in your books?
Well, she's not a guy. She's a crime reporter, so she's not actually an investigator, but she has connections into that world. So she knows criminals. She's reported on criminals. She's been to the jail. She has a lot of contacts and informants in the underworld that will serve her well during the book. But it's also the time period. So for Hannah, I think Berlin is as much a character as Hannah, and I think the 1930s is as much a character as Hannah. So the time and the place are very specific, and I try to make them very rich because those are what bring it alive. So it's not just, for me, place is very important. So if you look at any of my books, there's something about that place that intrigues me. So writing something that was very generic and set in a you know, suburb with no name wouldn't really interest me as much as a specific place. So for Hannah, it's 1931 Berlin. She's poor. She's an underdog. She's a writer. But she has some tools. You know, she's smart. She has friends in the underworld. She's got, you know, the ability to move around. She's beautiful, which she doesn't like, but it's useful for her. So there's a lot of different aspects to her.
Mm. I think that's a good point. So they don't have to be a cop or an investigator as such, but they do need these tools. They need some way to be able to find out information if they're not in the police. So they need the contact. So yeah, by book three, my character Jamie is out of the police and is now a private investigator, but she has those contacts back in the police. So you do need to kind of set those up, don't you? Because they can't. Well, I guess there's the amateur sleuth mystery, which often happens in cozies, doesn't it?
But those, I think, have a very different level of suspension of disbelief. So, you know, cozies, you can have a cat who solves a mystery, or You know, you can have a cat narrator who has a rich interior life. And those are things that you couldn't get away with in a more hard-boiled novel or a thriller. You know, it's a different promise. I mean, I think, I don't remember who said it, but a novel is a promise that you have for the reader. And I think you have to know what that promise is. So in a cozy, like the Sofia Salgado books that I write with Sean Black are just comedy, cozies, just utterly ridiculous, silly, funny stuff happening, all like the Janet Ivanovich books. And so you set up that's the promise. Whereas the Hannah books are set in Berlin in the 1930s. They're meticulously researched. I spent a lot of time making sure that every single detail was right. They're in the Holocaust Memorial Museum collection. They're serious books. And that's the promise. The promise when you see it is, you know, that's who Hannah is. That's what she's doing. And that's who, and then you know who Sophia is. And different readers want different experiences, or, you know, the same reader wants a different experience at different times.
Absolutely. And then setting, because that's really important too. You and I both do this, and we, you know, we've bonded over the Prague Golem and various settings that we've both used in different books. We've used similar settings. But, you know, my books are all around London and everything is about London. So, you know, it is... Yeah. You know, has to be true to that and has to be exact. So that's another question, like where does the truth end and the fiction begin? Is it literally just the character and the situation? Is every single other thing correct? You know, how far, do you know what I mean? Like, where does that fiction start?
I would say for the Hannah Fogel books, I tried to make every single detail that could be real, be real. Mm-hmm. So when she talks about a brand of cigarettes that really existed, it was called that. I got a set of newspapers from the 1931 that had all these ads in it. And so I was able to have that to draw on, to be very specific. So I would say every single thing that can be real is real. The subway stations are all correct. The street names are correct. The buildings where I mentioned a specific building, that building existed and it did look like that. But obviously Hannah didn't exist. However, some of the events that happened around her, she was there for Kristallnacht. That really happened. There for the Night of the Long Knives Purge. That really happened. And there's a lot of, I mean, in 1930s Germany, obviously, there's a lot of material that covered what was there. And there's a lot of diaries and newspapers and primary sources. And so I leaned on this pretty heavily. And then anywhere where I did diverge from reality, I mentioned that in my author's note.
Yeah. And I do author's notes as well. And I like that because you can, you know, and what I love is when people email me and say, hey, I've just been Googling like the places in your books, you know, like my book One Day in Budapest, people actually go and sort of go around the different places in Budapest. And I'm like, yeah, what I wrote didn't actually happen, but that is the place, you know, kind of thing. which is really cool. Okay. So let's talk about bad guys or antagonists, because, I mean, clearly you've got the Nazis, which, let's face it, are, I mean, you know, easy. Yeah, easy to pick. But I guess the main question there is, how do we make the bad guys not just cardboard cutout Nazi bad guys, for example?
Well, I think the bad guys are a character in your story, like the good guys or any other character. And because they're a character, to me, they're human. So they have all of the flaws that real humans have, and they have all of the advantages and disadvantages that real humans have. So in the Hannah Fogel books, the Anström is one of the Nazi bad guys, and he was a tremendously bad guy. But like, he was a very good friend of Hitler. He's one of Hitler's best friends. And Hitler had him executed in 1934 and like had nightmares about it for the rest of his life. So this was a man who, you know, helped bring Hitler to power. But he was also gay and out, and he wasn't particularly anti-Semitic. So the other Nazis were constantly like harassing him because he wasn't particularly anti-Semitic. And he's like, I don't really care what, you know, whatever you do with that is fine. You know, I kind of want to make Germany great again. was his kind of slogan. And so he was about, you know, building the army up, taking back the countries that they'd lost, and then taking more countries that he felt should have belonged to Germany all this time to begin with. But he, you know, he had an other life. He had all these other things that he did. He had friends, he had hobbies, he had flaws. He was adored by his men. He was very organized. He, you know, won a bunch of medals in World War I. He wrote a very bombastic memoir that was, you know, like required reading. And then the Nazis destroyed it after the purge. But he was a person. And I think you need to remember that every villain is a person. And they say every villain is a hero in his own story. So you have to figure out what their story is that's making them act the way they do.
Yeah.
So you have some pretty bad guys in your stuff. How do you make them so complex?
Yeah, I think I was thinking about that. I mean, for me, it's often a lot about their belief system as well. And, you know, and obviously it's very hard to say too much without giving too much away with the books. But, you know, I've got some quite political angles on my books too, around the sort of political elite in London with money who think they can do whatever they like, versus the misfits and the outcasts and the people who get scorned, but are actually, you know, good people and want to help the community. And so there's, which in London is a huge pressure, you know, between the super rich and the, you know, kind of normal people getting pushed out of places where they've lived for generations. And so it's, I think, thinking about, and then you think, okay, but then if you take the point of view of that political elite, which is, you know, if, without seeing it in a negative way. So, you know, we want to make the city even better. You know, we want to clean up the streets. And, you know, you can see that these things become important to those characters. So I think it's that empathy, which is so important for being a writer, is trying to put yourself in that point of view. Like, I want the best for my children is a very common, well, it's a common human feeling, and a super rich person feels that and does different things to, you know, can do different things to other people. So that, I think that's really important. And also, yeah, just humanizing them in a different way and giving them some kind of good scene. I mean, it, you know, it's called the save the cat moment in, you know, screenwriting, but I like House of Cards, which, you know, do you watch House of Cards?
I watched the first season.
Yeah.
But it's one of those where I can't get along with it. Everybody is so unsympathetic. It's tough for me.
Oh, well, that's funny, because what I enjoyed about the very first episode of House of Cards is he actually kills a dog. And it was a nod. It was a nod to Save the Cat. So, and if you're into screenwriting, you're like, oh, and I was just like pointing at the screen going, oh, that's so clever. And, you know, he and I'm like, yeah, because they did that to show, to demonstrate his character. So actually, let's talk about that, because I think foreshadowing is tremendously important for mystery, but also depth in a novel and layering of meaning and that kind of thing. So how would you define foreshadowing and maybe, you know, give some examples?
Well, I would say, well, foreshadowing, that in House of Cards is a good example of that. So when you're setting up something that the character will do later, so you can see that they have the potential in them to act in this way. And it's, you know, a smaller degree. So now it's a dog, then it's the president, but it's the idea that, you know, this is a person who's capable of evil. And it might be something as simple as, you know, killing a fly. It doesn't even have to be a dog. Or it can be something they see, or a metaphor of, you know, of what they're looking at. So when I write books, sometimes I will make a list of, this is going to sound dorky, but I'll make a list of like images and words and concepts that I want to put in there. Mm-hmm. So when I the Sanguine books with Jim, we were really conscious that we wanted these to be kind of gothic thrillers. So, you know, I made a list of all the color palettes that the characters could use that were the ancient characters. So they had, you know, the ochres and the golds and the silvers and the blacks and the colors that you would have had that were mineral based paint colors. And I know nobody ever noticed this but me. But then the newer characters could have different colors and different things that they noticed. And even if the reader isn't aware of that, I think it does seep in. And so for like the Hannah books, in the first book, I had scenes with her brother and he was dead and he was talking from beyond the grave. And it just confused people completely. And my agent said, I'll represent you if you take that out. I was like, okay. And I'd heard a lot of complaints from my beta readers as well. So I realized I wasn't getting it right. So I took him out. But in the original version, every time that he was going to come in, she touched this handkerchief that he'd given her. It was this red silk handkerchief. And I left that in. Even though it didn't link to anything anymore, it was still a reminder of him. And I've gotten emails from people who have said, I like how that makes her seem close to him. So even though I'd taken out all the pieces that should have connected to it, they still responded to that action. They still knew. They got the depth of that.
Mm.
So
No, that's really great. And I mean, obviously,
readers are very smart.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, we'll come back to readers being very smart. But, you know, that foreshadowing, I think, is so important. It can be really obvious, like the gun on the shelf has to go off by, you know, act three or whatever that quote is, Chekhov's gun. But, you know, I have in Desecration, the murder scene, the actual body is found in an anatomy museum. So, you know, the body is surrounded by body parts in jars. And that actually foreshadows the whole book, because the theme of the book is about anatomy and the meaning of the physical body and after death and that kind of thing. And it's, you know, quite a deep and meaningful undercurrent, but I don't say it in the book. I don't say the meaning of this book is, you know, you can do that with foreshadowing. And so the body parts in jars at the beginning, it's like, well, where, what will happen by the end with these kind of body parts? And there was one adaptation of And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie, you know, on BBC recently. And it's been ages since I've read the book, so I don't know if it's in the book. But at the beginning, in the very first scene, they're on a train and the pull blind on the train carriage is a little noose. And it was brilliant. And if people haven't read And Then There Were None, you know, I won't say what it is, but I was like, oh, that's brilliant. And this was a fleeting camera glance over the window of the train, and there was a clear noose pull, you know, like you would pull down the thing on the to hide the light from the window. And I was like, that's brilliant. That's foreshadowing incredibly well, and probably most people never saw it, but it puts something into the reader's mind that we recognize these symbols, and it adds a layer to the experience, even if we're not aware of it.
In the movie Get Out, I don't know if you saw that, but the horror movie Get Out, at the beginning, it's a wonderful movie. You should see it, especially as a writer, because the way they set things up and pay things off, you're just in awe. By the time you get to the beginning of at the end of the movie and you see where everything has fallen in, you're just like, oh my God, I have to rent that and watch it and take notes because it's that well put together. But at the beginning, there's a scene where they're driving in the car and it's a happy scene. She's going to meet her parents and they love each other. And it's happy, happy, happy. But as they're driving, there's this scene of the trees going by outside. And I don't know I don't know if it was the filter or the speed of the camera or whatever, but it was completely like 1970s horror trees. And so as you're watching it, you get very, very uneasy. And yet there's no specific thing you can point to that tells you why you're uncomfortable going along this sunny road, but you very much are. And I think movies get to cheat a little bit because they control your eye and you can't go back. Whereas if you're writing a book and you say, you know, it looked like a noose, then you've kind of hung a candle on it, right? You really pointed there in the text in a way that if they just see it flash by in a film, you can get away with it more.
That's a really good point. And like I said, I can't remember the text, but that type of thing, I think your thing with the color palette, I do that too. And we are both super geeks, as you said. I mean, you know, we love all this stuff. Super geeky. But that's also part of the fun, I think, of the mystery and the fun of writing. And what we should stress, if people are newer writers, is that you can go back and add this stuff in a second draft. And in fact, you probably will. I think foreshadowing is one of those things that you often do think about later. You get to a point and then you're like, oh, this would work even better if I went back to that chapter and I added in a little comment about something, because it has to be there for that to happen. Do you find yourself adding that stuff in a second draft?
I do. Yeah. My son is a novelist and he's 16 and he was struggling with his first book when he was writing it. And I was like, just write to the end and you can come back, because you are the writer god and you control all space, all time, and everything that moves. So you don't have to get it right the first time. So you don't need to feel the burden of that. You can write your first draft. It can have all of these flaws and all of these things that are missing, and you can come back and fix them, because nobody knows that it took you 10 drafts to get that perfect structure. And yeah, so you control time and space. You are the puppet master.
Okay, you're such a cool mom. No, but I do want to ask you about this, because I get emails a lot from young people and also from parents of young people who are clearly, I know this is not about the mystery, but just one question about kids, or young people. He's a young person. How are you encouraging him, or how would you tell other people listening to encourage their children to write? Because the one thing we hear is, don't do that. You're wasting your time. You'll never be able to make a living that way. Concentrate on your maths.
Well, I do say, you know, you need to get, it's good to study and get good grades and figure out what you want to do. And it doesn't have to be about writing. But I mean, I think the thing is, what's the point of concentrating on your maths if you get a job that you hate? And then suddenly 20 years later, you quit that job and you've been miserable for 20 years. And then you go become a writer.
That'd be me.
I mean, so what have you gained by telling your child to train for a job that they don't like? And I think the thing about writing that I'm constantly telling him over and over and over again is to really enjoy it, because I think there's so much myth out there of the damaged writer and the alcoholic writer and the drug addicted writer and the suffering writer. And you don't have to buy into that mythology. I mean, I am not a drinker or a drug user or any of those things. I'm happy and I really love writing. Like, I love sitting down on a page and making magical things happen that come out of my head. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to tell children that this should be fun, and you need to read a lot, of course, but you should enjoy it. And there's no guarantees. I mean, I have a couple of friends who have PhDs in science, and they've been published and they worked, and they're struggling to find jobs. And so he's like, should I be a scientist like you? And they're like, no, be a writer like your mom. There's no job security anywhere. Have fun. And I think there's something to that.
Mm. No, that's awesome. And also with your own career, so you're a hybrid author. You have traditional deals and you self-publish as well. So is that something that you're passing on, the sort of business side and how you can make these multiple streams of income?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I talked to him a lot about rights and control and being very careful. I mean, because I started out when you kind of signed away all your rights for life plus 75 years, and then they were gone forever. And so you only want to do that if the conditions of the deal are very, very good and you feel like that will benefit you. So I have friends who've signed on, you know, deals for books that are ebook only, and they haven't sold a lot of copies and they have no rights. So it's like, okay, so you've written the book, you've done the work, you've made a small sum of money, and then your chance is lost for that book. And there's nothing you can do. And so I'm probably, after having watched me go through traditional publishing, I think he's much more interested in self-publishing than going through that route, just because it's a lot of, writing is a lot of uncertainty anyway. And so many things are out of your control anyway, that, you know, you want to think twice before you give up the stuff that you have. And plus you love the characters. So when I wrote the Hannah Fogel books, they were all traditionally published, and I just recently got the rights back, and it was transformative. I was so excited to have those book back, to be able to write in that world again, to be able to, you know, go back and see Hannah. It's like I left Lars bleeding the back of a truck 5 years ago. That poor man has been bleeding in the back of a truck for 5 years. And I've been getting very angry emails that are getting more and more angry as time goes on from readers saying, you know, when are you going to tell us whether he lives or dies? And now I finally can, and I'm just so excited.
Oh, that's awesome. So are you now writing again in that series, are you?
I am. Yeah, I wrote a short story set in there that was from the point of view of her brother. So it was a prequel to book one. And then I'm going to be writing the next book in the series, which will hopefully come out next year. And so I get to go back to that world, and I've just missed it so much. So,
oh, that's awesome. Okay, so we're almost out of time. So we're in this box set that's out, a mystery box set, and in that box set is Desecration by J.F. Penn.
And Trace of Salt by Rebecca Cantrell, and 8 books in total and 2 anthologies.
Yeah, it's a super, super mystery bundle. So you can get that bundle. And if you're watching the video, I'll include the link below, or you can go to thecreativepen.com/mystery-bundle, or just go to storybundle.com and it will be there. And of course, if it's gone by the time you listen to this interview, you can get our books all the usual places that books are sold, or on jfpen.com and
RebeccaCantrell.com.
There we go, where you can find all of our books. So I guess, is there anything else that we think, you know, coming back to the mystery thing, is there anything else that people who are writing mysteries should remember? I mean, are there, you know, think, you know, books that they should read. That's probably the next one. Yeah, they're books that they should read where that will help them write a mystery. Any good resources that you've found yourself?
I would say the best writing book I've read is called Screenwriting Tips for Authors by Alexander Sokolov, which is really fantastic because a lot of books tell you about Act One and Act Three. And then Act Two is most of the book and they don't tell you anything, where she really goes into the details of it. And another thing she does is she's like, make a list of 10 movies that you love, make a list of 10 main characters that you love. And it comes from a place of, what do you love? What excites you? And you kind of move forward from there. So I think she gives you a lot of structure and a lot of passion. And it's very well put together. It's a very good analysis. I like Save the Cat by Blake Snyder. It's a nice, quick overview of the beats that are in movies. It's formulaic, but I think it's manageable for newer writers to say, okay, here's the 15 beats that you need. Here they are on one page. And then you can just be like, I can do that. I can write a one-page outline. And then you can kind of go from there. Because I think it's so easy to get overwhelmed in writing. And so if you have tools that move you forward, that's a good thing. But I also would say that your process is your process. And if the tools are slowing you down or stopping you or blocking you, then those aren't your tools and you should try to find other tools that work for you.
Yeah, exactly. As always, there are no rules. There are some guidelines around mystery, but certainly there are no rules. Okay, so tell us again, where can people find you and your books online?
They're at Amazon, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, but www.rebeccacantrell.com. And there's a list of all of my books there and links to everything and, you know, excerpts and reviews and things like that.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Becky. That was great.
Thank you. Have a good one.
I hope you enjoyed the interview with Rebecca Cantrell and that you learned lots about writing mystery. And you can get the fantastic limited time bundle at storybundle.com/mystery. And next week, I'm talking about how to use dictation to write faster and stay healthy with Scott Baker. And I have actually been getting back into dictation, walking along the canal path with my little dictaphone. So we'll be talking about that. And I know so many people are interested in that topic. So look forward to that and I will see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.